The Torah content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions.
Hello, I'm Rabbi Matt Schneeweis, and this is the Stoic Jew podcast, where we explore the relationship between Judaism and Stoicism. And today's episode is dedicated Lezecher Nishmas Eliezer ben Hendel. Today's reading is a continuation of the letter from Seneca to his mother that we've been reading all week, entitled The Consolation of Helvia. In the last episode, Seneca mentioned that he was going to convince his mom that exile, which is the penalty that he was suffering for the alleged affair with Caligula's sister, that exile is not as bad as she thinks it is, and he's not suffering as much as she thinks he is. So he spends a great deal of time elaborating on that and explaining why exile is not so bad. I personally didn't find a lot of it that interesting, so we're skipping a whole bunch. I think we ended off on section 5 of the letter. Now we're up to section 11. So in this section, he's going to focus on one of the perceived evils of exile is the fact that you have to give up all of your wealth and possessions, and kind of like start off without anything. So Seneca writes, "But you object, the exile is likely to miss his wardrobe and his house." Okay, that's the objection. So now Seneca argues, "If he wants these two only for use, neither shelter nor cover will fail him. It takes as little to protect the body as to feed it. Nothing that nature has made necessary for man has she made difficult. But if he desires garments of purple deep-dyed, interwoven with gold and spangled in various tints and designs, it is not nature's fault that he is poor, but his own. Even if you restore all that he has, all that he has lost, you will waste your effort. For after he is restored, he will fall farther short of his desires than as an exile he fell short of what he once had. If his desire is for sideboards displaying vessels of shining gold, for silver ennobled by the signature of old masters, for bronze made valuable by the quaint fad of a few collectors, for a horde of servants that would clutter the most spacious mansions, for mules forcibly crammed to make them fat, for marbles quarried in every country, even if he heaps these things up in piles, they will never satisfy his insatiable appetite any more than any quantity of water will satisfy a man whose craving is begotten not by a lack of moisture, but by a fever burning in his vitals. That is not thirst, but distemper. This applies not only to money or food. Every craving which springs from a fault rather than a need has the same character. However much you give, it will only be a stage in cupidity, not its fulfillment. A man who keeps himself within the bounds of nature, therefore, will not feel poverty, but he who exceeds those bounds will be pursued by poverty even in the greatest opulence. For necessities, even exile is sufficient. For superfluities, not even kingdoms are." Okay, Seneca is such a good writer, by the way. I just have to comment on that. I love that last part. So let's pause in the letter for a second here just to reflect on what he's saying. A lot of these episodes that I make focus on the differences between Judaism and Stoicism. It's nice occasionally to see something where I feel like Judaism and Stoicism are completely aligned, and this is definitely an area. I'm reminded almost word for word of the Rambam, which we read in an earlier episode in the Mor Nevuchim 3:12, which I'm going to only read a portion of here. I recommend reading that the entire portion, but he says, "The soul, when accustomed to superfluous things, acquires a strong habit of desiring things which are neither necessary for the preservation of the individual nor for that of the species. This desire is without limit, whilst things which are necessary are few in number and restricted within certain limits." This desire is without a limit. "Whilst things which are necessary are few in number and restricted within certain limits, what is superfluous is without end. For example, you desire to have your vessels of silver, but golden vessels are still better. Others have vessels even of sapphire, or perhaps they can be made of emerald or rubies or any other substance that could be suggested. Those who are ignorant and perverse in their thought are constantly in trouble and pain because they cannot get as much of superfluous things as a certain other person possesses. They, as a rule, expose themselves to great dangers, for example, by sea voyage or service of kings, and all this for the purpose of obtaining that which is superfluous and not necessary. When they thus meet with the consequences of the course which they adopt, they complain of the decrees and judgments of God. They begin to blame the time and wonder at the lack of justice in its changes, that it has not enabled them to acquire great riches with which they could buy large quantities of wine for the purpose of making themselves drunk, and numerous concubines adorned with various kinds of ornaments of gold, embroidery, and jewels for the purpose of driving themselves to sexual indulgence beyond their capacities, as if the whole universe existed exclusively for the purpose of giving pleasure to these low people." And the Rambam goes on, and he goes on to make the same point that Seneca made about how God provides everything that is, I guess, the more necessary something is, then the more abundant it is in the world, and the less necessary it is, then the less of it there is in the world. You know, so it's not God's fault for not providing excess amounts of these elaborate opulent things that people crave. I'll read that. Okay, might as well read it. He says, observe how nature proves the correctness of this assertion. The more necessary a thing is for living beings, the more easily it is found and the cheaper it is. The less necessary it is, the rarer and dearer it is. For example, air, water, food are necessary to man. Air is most necessary, for if man is without air a short time, he dies, whilst he can be without water a day or two. Air is also undoubtedly found more easily and cheaper than water. Water is more necessary than food, for some people can be 4 or 5 days without food, provided they have water. Water also exists in every country in larger quantities than food and is also cheaper. The same proportion can be noticed in the different kinds of food. That which is more necessary in a certain place exists there in larger quantities and is cheaper than that which is less necessary. No intelligent person, I think, considers musk, amber, rubies, and emerald as very necessary for man except as medicines. They, as well as other like substances, can be replaced for this purpose by herbs and minerals. And then he says that, yeah, okay, I think that's a good place to stop in the excerpt from the Rambam. Again, you got to read that whole chapter. That's one of the best chapters in the Mor Nebuchim, in my opinion, in terms of how much it's impacted me. So the point being that that if you are, as long as your desires are in line with nature, meaning in line with your needs, so then you can easily find enough to take care of your needs. But if your desire is for something superfluous, then you're always going to be unhappy and your desire is going to be unlimited. And I really like the point that Seneca made here, that by distinguishing between, in his example, thirst and distemper, meaning both the man who is thirsty for water and the person who has a fever and craves water, both of them are experiencing a desire, but the desires are completely different in nature. The one stems from the fact that his body has a need and is signaling that need by bringing up a desire that is accompanied by pain. But the person who has a sickness and needs water, that's due to something going wrong in his body. And and like he said at the end there, what was the thing here? Where is it? Oh yeah, every craving which springs from a fault rather than a need has the same character. Right. So you have to distinguish between cravings that come from faults, or I would say like, artificial or unnatural cravings that come from a distemper in your character or in a habit or something like that, versus the things that the body actually needs. So in other words, the fact that it's a craving does not mean that it is good for you and does not mean that it will bring you happiness. So then he says, Seneca says, it is the mind which makes men rich. The mind accompanies us into exile, and when it has found adequate sustenance for the body, even in the most desolate wilderness, its own resources provide an abundance which it can enjoy. The mind has no more to do with money than have the immortal gods. All those objects revered by the untutored intellects, enslaved to their own bodies, marbles, gold, silver, polished round tables of great size, are earthy dross which an unflawed mind aware of its own nature cannot love. For it itself is light and unencumbered, ready to soar aloft as soon as it shall be released. In the meantime, so far as the curbs of the members and the heavy load of body which surrounds it allow, it contemplates things divine in swift and airy thought. Neither, therefore, can the mind be exiled, for it is free, kin to the gods, adequate to all space and all times, for thought ranges through all heaven and has accessible to all time, past and future. This trivial body, the prison and fetter of the soul, is tossed hither and yon. Upon it tortures, brigandage, diseases do their worst. But the mind itself is sacred and everlasting and not subject to violence. So the pasuk that immediately came to my mind when I read this, even though there are lots of pasukim that could come to mind, is Mishlei 15:15, which says, Kol yemei ani ra'im v'tov lev mishteh tamid, which means all the days of the poor person are bad, but tov lev, which I would translate here as someone who has a good mind, mishteh tamid, it's a constant party. Okay, so the Meiri explains, and then this is a lot of Mefarshim give the same explanation. He says, Lufia Nigla, according to the overt external meaning, Koyime Ani, all the days of a poor person. So what is a poor person here? He says, it's not poverty in terms of wealth. It's Vuhu Oso She'eno Sameach B'chalko, someone who is not happy with his portion, who is not content with what he has. And this is quoting the definition of wealth from Pirkei Avos 4:1, Ben Zoma says, Ezihu Ashir, who is wealthy, Hasameach B'chalko, one who is content with his portion. So That's the poor person in the pasuk. What does it mean that his days are bad? Ki hu nivhal lahon, because he is frantically clamoring for money. Ve'eino lo tisba osher, and his eye will not be sated by wealth. V'yom yom yosif mach ov nafsho latova, and each and every day his soul will increase its pain for the good that he seeks. Aval tov lev, but someone with a good mind, rotzolomer hasameach b'chelko, one who's happy with what he has, mishteh tamid, constant party, rotzolomer mistapik v'omid b'simcha, kiluhu b'mishteh tamid, meaning that he has enough and he is in a state of joy as if he is partying constantly. And again, the fact that Seneca and you know, the Meiri put this all in terms of the mind really is emphasizing what the true commodity is. Where's the true wealth? I mean, Pirkei Avos says the true wealthy person is someone who is satisfied with what he has, but what is the true commodity? What is the wealth itself? It's a correct realistic perspective. It's knowledge. And a quotation that comes to mind from Nedarim Daf Mem Aleph Amud Aleph, which I expect people to quote on the pasuk. I had to hunt it down though. I didn't see anyone quote it. Maybe I just didn't look hard enough. Amar Abaye said, Naktinan, we hold, Ein ani ela bedea. The only poverty is knowledge, is in terms of knowledge. Meaning, if you're poor or rich, that's not measured. That's not a measure of your possessions. It's a measure of your knowledge. But ma'arava in the West, Amri, they say, and this one is cuter to say in Aramaic. Dedabe kulabe, delo dabe mabe. The one who has knowledge in him has everything in him, and the one who doesn't have knowledge in him, what is in him? Da kani machaser, da lo kani makani. If he acquired knowledge, then what does he lack? And if he didn't acquire knowledge, then what has he acquired? So everything comes down to your knowledge and to your perspective. And that's really what Seneca is saying here, is that when you're in exile, yeah, you lose all of your material possessions. But as long as you have your mind and you have your knowledge, then you really have everything you need. You know, and again, he is acknowledging you do have to have, water and food and a simple garment in terms of what your actual needs are. But everything else is superfluity. And the more you're attached to superfluities, then the more you are exposing yourself to the ups and downs of fortune and ups and downs of mood and happiness that come with it. So better off being happy with the knowledge you have and with and being sameach b'chelko, being happy with what you, content with what you have. Now, when I was compiling these sources, I was not thinking about Shavuos, okay? But as I started talking, I realized, oh, you know, this is appropriate for Shavuos, okay? Now, why is that? So you might think, people think that the Shavuos is about Matan Torah, okay? And I gave a shiur on this, which I'll link to. According to Chazal, it's about Matan Torah. But if you look at the Torah itself, okay, the actual psukim, it never says in the Torah that Shavuos is about Matan Torah. Not one word, okay? It doesn't even say that the Torah was given at this time on the day of Shavuos, okay? Mm-hmm. If you look at the Torah, what does it say that Shavuos is about? It's the Chag HaKatzir. It's the harvest festival. Now, in the Bravanel, this is the Bravanel Shita for the entire Shavuos, is that Shavuos is all about the harvest festival. Now, when I say harvest festival, you might think Sukkos, right? But people don't realize there are two harvest festivals. When I say people, I mean like it's not in the popular consciousness. People think of Sukkos as the harvest festival. That's really the festival of ingathering. But the Chag HaKatzir, the festival of beginning the harvest, is Shavuos. So it's hard for us to relate to these agricultural dimensions of the Torah. But the closest thing we could do is take the lessons gleaned from, that was our agricultural pun, gleaned from that we glean from learning about how the role agriculture played in that society and then apply it to our own society. So what would you be thinking of at the beginning of the harvest? You would be thinking about all of the produce you're going to gather in and the money and the abundance that you're going to have. So I think this letter from Seneca and these teachings from Chazal and from the Psukim and from the Rambam, all these teachings really should frame our should cause us to reflect on how we relate to our income and to our money and our livelihood. Even though we don't, in our jobs, have a harvest season that begins at the time of Shavuos, we can still utilize Shavuos as an opportunity to reflect on how we relate to our material wealth and focus on what true wealth is. That is it for today's episode. If you've gained from what you've learned here today and would like to support my production of even more Torah content, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/RabbiSchneeweis. Link is in the description. And, it never occurred to me really to to offer, if people want to sponsor specific episodes, you know, by making a donation, either a one-time contribution or becoming a patron, I'm happy to do that. So feel free to do that. Thank you to my listeners for listening, and thank you to my patrons for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone.